Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Aaron and Trishul discuss behavioral finance and behavioral economics in the context of last year's coronavirus roller coaster. Humans are optimistic and pessimistic beings, and some of us are both at the same time, which seems like a contradiction. By acknowledging these sometimes conflicting feelings and focusing on the decision-making process, you can overcome emotional barriers to make wiser, more rational choices over time. And the benefits to your long-term well-being can be incredible. So why not make the shift in your life? And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Great to be here as well. Today, we're going to be talking about kind of 2020 and the stock market, and more specifically, how people felt about stocks in 2020. It was a really big roller coaster year with some of the biggest drawdowns in terms of speed and magnitude that we had seen going through March. But after, I think, the third week of March, we saw some of the biggest gains, also in terms of kind of speed and magnitude when it comes to the stock market. And both of those create a lot of emotions. Kind of the down feels really bad, really fast, and the up can be almost happens too fast to get excited about it. And this is one of those good examples that if you were able to resist the emotional feelings in March and just kind of stay the course, you probably ended up pretty well in 2020 for stock investments. And so today, Trishul and I want to talk about some of those feelings related to stocks and get into a kind of behavioral finance and some of the psychology there and just kind of talk about this idea of like, how do you feel when you see certain things and what are the implications of that? So Trishul, do you have a kind of a quick example of behavioral finance or behavioral psychology that can kind of give us a primer for the difference between classic psychology or the classic homo economicus?
Yeah, happy to, Aaron. And it certainly has been a wild ride this year, hasn't it?
Very wild for so many reasons.
Yeah. It's even hard to believe that the market's at an all-time high, given all that's happened at this point, or very close to the all-time high. So when we look back at how individuals behave, what we've actually discussed over the course of these podcast episodes is that there is this understanding that markets gravitate towards being efficient, meaning they tend to be governed by rationality, the notion that you have rational players who are making rational decisions. And over time, that leads to sensible prices for the markets. And what that kind of says is you can't really outsmart the market because the market prices are fair. They reflect information that is already known to everybody. And what that means is you shouldn't be able to time the market and do better, or you shouldn't be able to pick certain securities and do better. It should pretty much be an even playing field, meaning there's an equal amount of winners and losers. And on average, if you kind of aim for that market return by investing in a passive index, you will do pretty well because of that. But then there's this other understanding that, wait, markets aren't rational at all. Look at the wild swings we saw this year. We saw huge movements. I recall, Aaron, we had a podcast episode a few weeks after the pandemic started to really shake things up. And it was kind of towards the beginning, but we saw like a 12% drop in a week. And mm-hmm. that was just kind of the beginning. It bottomed out like 30% over a few weeks of really high amounts of turbulence. And we were kind of giving a similar thought process back then of, you know, we don't know which way it's going to go, and it's going to be hard to time whether you should be in and out. So staying the course is sensible. But at the end of the day, there was a lot of irrationality going on, given the wild swings that we saw. And that kind of lays the theme that maybe markets aren't fully efficient. Maybe irrationality does play a big part in how humans behave. And that's also reflected in how the stock market behaves. And that's what behavioral finance is all about. And I think it tries to attack this notion of rationality from two perspectives. The first perspective that behavioral finance kind of thinks about is the notion that there are times when individuals, as they approach certain decisions when it comes to money, that don't end up being fully rational. And given that understanding, they might actually be hurting themselves rather than helping themselves. So that's one class of behavioral finance that we'll certainly dig into. And then the second notion is kind of like the next level, or like the second order of that understanding, meaning if you happen to know that certain people are behaving irrationally under certain conditions, can you perhaps exploit that? If you know they're going to do something that's against their best interests, and from the market perspective, can you kind of make the opposite play and kind of do better? And that's where behavioral finance could perhaps be used in a more active approach to kind of even do better than the market. So I think there's two main themes here that people may see when it comes to behavioral finance.
Okay. So do you have a kind of a quick example that doesn't have to be financial perspective or financial specific, but just when we're kind of trying to discuss behavior and how that is not always rational, but maybe right. If we understand why it might be.
Yeah. So one thing that comes up a lot is this notion of overconfidence, where we tend to see this notion that humans are optimistic beings. We kind of have to be optimistic to want to do a lot of the crazy things that we do. And it's kind of ingrained in us to kind of seek out new and adventurous things, like sailing across the ocean, not knowing that the world is gonna be a sphere. Mm-hmm. Although they probably did know that, but
yeah,
my kind of point is there's a sense of being a little more optimistic that's kind of ingrained with all of us. And this has actually been studied. We mentioned this paper way back about this poll of citizens. It was done by, I believe, a bunch of European researchers. I think the paper's author was Svensson. It was in like the 80s. And they just asked a group of Swedes, what percent of you Swedes do you think are better than each of you? Raise your hand if you think you're better than the average driver. And if you ask an average room of people, you're going to get more than 50% saying they're better than average, when mathematically that can't be true.
80% of the population thinks they're better than average.
Right. So that's one example of just people being overconfident in their ability. And this kind of translates to stock investing, where you have these active portfolio managers out there. And if you take a room of active portfolio managers who manage these different mutual funds and ETFs and hedge funds and things like that, and you ask them to, you know, raise your hand if you're going to do better than the average, well, if you think about it for a second, only half of those people should be raising their hands. But I don't know if your boss sees you not raising your hand, if you're going to make it back home with a job.
So that's also, I was like, there's some incentives there. Shouldn't 100% of the room say that they're going to be above average?
Which is kind of crazy, right? So you have a scenario where only half of them can, in theory, be better than average, but all of them kind of need to be to keep their job.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's an interesting take of it, just projecting that classic driver study of being above average to money managers. When I was thinking when it comes to behavioral finance, there's been different studies about kind of loss aversion and how one example is, it's not exactly related, but it's kind of a combination of studies. So if you ask people, would you like $100 today or $101 tomorrow? Most people chose $100 today. But if you ask, would you like $100 this time next year or $101 366 days from now? Most people chose $101 366 days. And kind of they do enough of these experiments and change dollar values. And there's understand that people have kind of poor internal discounting of the time value of money. But one of the kind of general conclusions from a variety of experiments like this was that people tend to feel losses worse than they feel positive from a gain of the same magnitude. And it's usually about 2 to 1. So a loss hurts twice as much as a comparative gain feels good. And so I'm curious if you can think of or seen studies of how this idea of kind of loss aversion and the feelings associated with them, which is also kind of why we do see some of these emotional cycles of being scared when the market's down. But what are some of your takeaways from that idea?
It's interesting because I kind of see loss aversion as being the yang to like the overconfidence yin, where with the overconfidence, you have people who are instinctively being more optimistic than they should be based upon rational information. And then with loss aversion, you kind of see like the opposite flavor of people being more pessimistic than they likely should be given information that's readily known. And indeed, the loss aversion was put forward by a team of researchers in the 60s. We mentioned them again, probably a lifetime ago in podcast years, but maybe it was last year. It was by the research of Tversky and Kahneman, and they
Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky.
Yeah. So when we first mentioned them, we looked at them under the rubric of behavioral finance, and these two were conducting this type of research, this seminal work on understanding that there are distinct ways where people behave irrationally, and loss aversion was a big thing that they keyed in upon with their research. So with your 2 to 1 example, to kind of put some, you know, statistics behind it, if you have a fair coin and, you know, Aaron, if we bet on that and I win $100 if it's heads and you win $100 if it's tails, well, then our expectation is even, right? It's mm-hmm. a fair coin. So we should both have the same amount of chance of winning. But it turns out with loss aversion, Aaron, I'm not going to play that bet unless I get 2 to 1 odds, meaning unless I get $200 for the chance of losing that 100. That's what they learned from this research, meaning you need to have a pretty unbalanced winning ratio or a pretty high probability of winning to take on that bet or that's what the average person looks for when they try to make a play. And it's interesting because with a fair coin, even a slight edge in the odds of winning, meaning just a dollar more, would be enough for a rational player to say, hey, that's free money right there. But in fact, you need twice as much money to put that $100 at risk.
Yeah, I think another way to phrase that is experimenter would, I'll give you $50 or you flip a coin, heads, you get 100, tails, you get 0. And so the expected value of that coin flip is also $50. No one takes the coin flip. Everyone takes that $50. And if you start to, okay, I'll give you the $50 or a coin flip, heads you get 110, tails you get 0. So now the expected value of that coin flip is $55. People are still taking the 50. And it has to get up to somewhere closer to $200 if it's heads and $0 if it's tails. We're getting that 2-to-1 value for people to give up. So we have an expected value of 100 for people to give up that known $50.
Yeah, that's a great way to play it. And it's interesting with statistics. We kind of mentioned this not too long ago when we discussed statistics, where if you get to flip that coin once, then yeah, you're going to, you know, this is a once in a lifetime chance. You get to flip it one time, then yeah, you're probably going to take that sure thing of taking the $50 rather than flipping the coin. But it's interesting because when you're doing these types of coin flipping, when you're investing, you're kind of flipping every day, right? Mm-hmm. And over your lifetime, you have literally thousands and thousands of chances of flipping for a expectation that's in your favor, because markets tend to go up over time. Yet still, there's this notion of perceived risk when people are actually putting their money to work and they have a chance of losing, you know, this $50 that they have in their hand rather than putting it to work in the market.
Yeah, that if we can compound that expected value, like you said, even if it's expected value of $51 versus 50, if we can keep compounding that and get as many coin, we should be signing up for as many coin flips as they'll give us.
Yeah, if they give you an unlimited amount, I'd flip that coin all day, right? And we'd be retired by the end of next year.
So, but human beings, they don't like giving up the $50. I think they've also almost done experience where they'll hand you the $50 bill and say, okay, do you want to buy the coin flip? And it's like, there's actually a difference between you get to choose $50 with expected value versus if you have the $50, you have to give it up for that risk. I think that comes into play even more.
Yeah. And so not only did Tversky and Kahneman understand that this bias exists, but it was just phenomenal that this bias was so large. Mm-hmm. We're talking about rational individuals, and we're talking about a bias that's, you know, not a dollar or 1% or 2% difference. It's really a huge difference, a 2-to-1 odd. So what that really means is we're talking about something that can really have a profound effect on human behavior. And for this work, they both didn't win the Nobel Prize, but Kahneman did. Unfortunately, Tversky passed away before given the prize was awarded, given that the Nobel Prize isn't awarded, but they certainly both deserved it, even according to Kahneman.
Yeah, it's posthumously. I also found it to say they're both psychologists. They won the Nobel Prize in economics. That was the other kind of big breakthrough at that time. They were kind of the first non-economists to win the Nobel Prize in economics.
Yeah, so it basically spawned this whole field of understanding where when you're looking at economic variables and economic consequences, that it's important to understand human behavior. You mm-hmm. don't really need to only look at, or it does not make sense to only look at the rational perspective. Understanding where irrationality can play into things is also important.
Yeah, and so that's kind of, we've seen, you'll see drawings on financial advisors' art walls or cartoons of when markets are down, the natural feeling is to sell. I'm scared. I want to hold on to what I have. I don't want to take on any more risk. But when markets are up, they tend to feel kind of greedy and that overconfidence. It's like, okay, I want to buy more. And emotionally, just the natural reaction is to sell low and buy high. When every person knows rationally, no, you have to do the opposite. When markets are down, that's when you buy. And when markets are up, that's when you sell. And those are fairly hard emotions to overcome in many conversations.
Yeah, they are indeed. As advisors, something that we've kind of mentioned in the past is there's this notion of what the investment returns happen to be. Mm-hmm. And then we notice that investors, when given the opportunity to make investments, don't make those investment returns. They make less. They make returns that are less than what the investment happens to return because of these behavioral issues, these behavioral or cognitive biases that kind of pull people away from what makes the most sense.
So what is the kind of next level? If we kind of understand this concept of, they're like, both overconfidence and loss aversion exist, we can see how they play out with the stock market or stocks, even individual stocks. What are some of the other kind of next level takeaways that you have?
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, there's been kind of two big plays with behavioral finance as it relates to the markets. And the first big one is just the understanding that not all players are rational, and there could be widespread irrationality that's frankly been studied at this point, to the point where a lot of these things are kind of well known, yet they still seem to occur. So that's kind of the first point. But the second point I mentioned is, well, this occurred to many people or many professionals as well. If we understand this notion that individuals tend to be consistently irrational, can we not exploit that to make money? And that's frankly a lot of what I used to do, you know, when I had my stint at the hedge fund, where our job was to understand these types of biases and use them to our advantage.
Do you have any examples of kind of how that played out, or kind of what your actions were?
Yeah. So another bias that is also common is this notion of recency bias. And we kind of mentioned this in another light, probably a podcast decade ago, sometime last year. And what we mentioned there is investors tend to put a little bit more weight on recent events than is statistically sensible. For example, having the analogy I like to put forward is when we used to live in Florida, if it's been many years without a hurricane, we often get quite complacent and we think, you know, do I really need to have that flood insurance or that very low deductible? Why do I have that in the first place? Maybe I'll drop that policy and get a much cheaper policy. But, you know, right after the hurricane hits, what does everybody do? They say, oh, that's why. Okay, I'm going to load up on policies. In fact, I'm going to double down and I'm going to get the best Cadillac policy for my home out there in case, you know, there's dew on the lawn, I want that covered as well. And what ends up happening is people overpay at that point for insurance and downside protection. And there's this kind of play again of irrationality where recent events, what's been going on recently, gets an overestimation of risk. So that this is something that I've studied in the space of the volatility markets, and I've understood that this also plays in the derivative space, where market participants tend to buy downside protection more after recent events, and that overpayment can be exploited for an opportunity.
Yeah, I think that the recency bias is fairly strong, not just in terms of finances, but in any kind of prediction, there's a strong bias for kind of the thing that happened more recently is more likely to continue, whereas a better analysis structure tries to kind of get as much data as possible and try to, and there's probably some discounting, but I look at, so I like paying attention to sports, and I like the NFL, and Football Outsiders is a great statistical analysis of NFL teams, and they have over time been studying and finding out and kind of been confirmed by other analytics groups that preseason predictions of team strength still have value all the way through the season, that you still want to consider what your original assessment of the team was, and you want to kind of add more data as they play games, and as you get more games played, you get more information. But incorporating those preseason predictions before any games have played tends to be more valuable than just looking at, say, the last month, the last four games. And kind of when we try to use statistics, try to kind of add in that rationality, a lot of it is using data and analysis to overcome a variety of these biases. And so a lot of times when I'm talking to clients, and clients will even talking about their feelings. And so coming, for example, last February and March, sometimes it's just, it's acknowledging that, yes, it makes sense to be scared, but we're going to try and use some prior analysis of what is this money for to not let the emotion drive our decision now. And we can kind of act, we have kind of acknowledge the bias or acknowledge the behavioral aspect so that we can overcome it. And it sounds like that's kind of what you did with your hedge fund strategies, that when everyone else is overpaying for insurance, you're specifically trying to overcome that feeling. Because I guess, did you have kind of similar feelings? Like, did ever feel like your strategy could be wrong?
Most certainly. And, you know, part of being a professional investor is to try to take those feelings and, you know, put them in a box and, you know, close it in the cupboard and, you know, tie it up and walk away and really try to keep to what the data is saying. That's a large part of what it takes to kind of be successful, not to let the emotions follow what should be done. So really letting the data and knowing what we know and knowing what we don't know drive our decisions, that's certainly been a large part of it. Although what I do have to also say is, again, that was our job to understand these biases, study them, conduct research. My job was heading up a research team, frankly. And the goal there is to find these anomalies and study them statistically and see if we can understand them to the point where we can make an edge and make some money. Now, what I also want to say, given a lot of the themes that I've been putting forward or that we've also been collectively putting forward over many of these episodes, is trying to outsmart the market in this fashion is an approach, but it's certainly not the easiest approach to be able to do this consistently over a lifetime with all of one's capital. So kind of something I've mentioned a couple of times is, just because the market is irrational doesn't mean it's going to be so easy for me to figure out when that irrationality exists to the point where I can profit off of it, such that I know that it's going to go away in a sufficient amount of time so that I can also retain that profit or capture that profit on an after-tax basis. So that there's a lot of moving parts there, and there's nothing to say that you spend all of this time researching and figuring out something and you think you have something and it seems to be working, and then, whoops, a bunch of other people have figured it out as well. And there goes, you know, that notion. Or it could just be you hit a rough string of X amount of time and it's just a period where it's fallen out of flavor. But adding all of this together just kind of means that you probably don't want to put all your money into one of these types of ideas. So you need a bunch of these types of ideas. And all of a sudden you're on a completely different animal of trying to outsmart the market. And it's a real tough game to play.
Yeah. I think I was looking, there's a period kind of years ago, I was looking at REITs and trying to understand non-traded REITs. And this was at a stage kind of before I truly understood all the internal costs. and kind of just how those hurt. But we had my former firm had kind of collectively decided, yeah, we're going to use some of these non-traded REITs as a diversifier. And I remember kind of looking over the next few years of returns for those clients that were invested, and some did particularly well. So some did amazingly well and kind of better than expected. That was my first indicator of, okay, if these are getting these great returns, I may not have understood the risk that we were taking on to get these returns. And one in particular did very, very poorly. It was something like a 70% loss over the scale of 4 or 5 years. And in the end, what happened was, because we had done, I think, 5 or so per client, they had actually gotten just really, really close to average real estate returns of a REIT, a publicly traded REIT. And so it's one of those things of, because we diversified across a few, we mitigated all of the kind of the worst case and the best case. And so we kind of brought everything back to that middle. And there are times that feels like, okay, we had a kind of a decent idea, worked out for some, worked out for the other, but like it ended up kind of adding more complexity to just get average returns. And kind of the more we reduced the risk, the more we, by diversifying, we just got back to what we could have been with a kind of easier publicly traded REIT. And there are times that I do feel that way of one strategy, kind of the concentration is high risk, high reward. And I saw that play out. And diversification really cuts off both the top and the bottom. And sometimes that makes more sense. But sometimes people, they want that high, they're willing to, if they understand the risk, they're willing to take that to get that high reward. It does, you kind of have to take that bet. You can't get excess returns through a diversified strategy.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's really interesting, because you would think even in the institutional space that they might have gravitated towards a solution that, given enough horsepower, they can overcome all of these concerns. But even having seen clients and worked with clients that have scaled, you know, from the hundreds of millions to the billions to, you know, plus 10 billion, I noticed that there's this constant tug and push and pull of wanting to come up with these great ideas and invest in them in a concentrated fashion, but then also understanding that, wait, we can't do that. We need to diversify across all of these different buckets. And at the end of the day, you kind of end up doing both, which means you're diversified across these really fancy ideas. And it kind of means you're back to square one, just like how you said. So you were paid a lot of money. You have a lot of research teams doing a lot of fancy things to kind of get you back to, oh, is that worse than a 60-40 return at this point?
Yeah, there's so many times where it's, oh, that's a good idea. And if we do that good idea and this good idea and this good idea, like I said, are we better off than just up 60-40 like everyone else?
Yeah, because really to initiate these good ideas, you have to find lots of good ideas, because you can't put all your money in too few, but they all have to kind of pan out above the average. So you got to find a room of managers, tell them all to raise their hands if they think they're better than average, and end up picking the ones that actually ended up being better than average. And then you got to make sure you don't pay them too much so that all your excess returns ends up in their pockets.
Yeah, yeah. So when you're working with clients, have you noticed your own feelings when it comes to kind of some of these behavioral finance acknowledgements? Maybe not telling them explicitly, but where rationally you know this recommendation is best for them, but it might not feel that way even as you're giving that recommendation.
It's hard to say. I what I try to honestly do is I try to give my I try to give a good amount of understanding of why I'm making the recommendation. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, I also say, you know, the final decision is up to the client. It's certainly their money, and it's their opportunity to take whatever understanding I can put their way and then make a hopefully more informed decision on what to do. And at the end of the day, what I try to put forward is, frankly, what I think makes the most sense from my perspective, what I would do with my own money. And even over the course of this year, as I was encouraging clients and, you know, managing these accounts to kind of stay the course, I felt like, given the amount of understanding that I put across on why this decision is the most sensible, I think I felt fairly comfortable putting it forward.
There have been times, I guess, a lot of my feelings I can, I don't want to say mitigate, but kind of acknowledge is by, I guess, focusing on that decision-making process. Like you said, because you explain why you're making the recommendation, and that recommendation is kind of for this point in time, that's allowed me to overcome some of the feelings, because I've had, actually, most of the time I am making a recommendation and it's kind of not worked out, just, and it's actually just kind of related to what the market has done over the last decade, is I may have recommended being more conservative, and if they listen to me, they're just fine. But there are actually a couple times, like actually my dad, he got to be 60, he was looking at retiring, and I wanted him to, he was invested in a lot in stocks and he was really enjoying it. I wanted him to get more conservative. Right? Like, you know, you should be more in bonds. And kind of, we talked about the risks and kind of, if the market goes down this much, here's what you'll have to do. We kept enough in cash to cover lifestyle expenses for 1 to 2 years, depending on where he was. He had a Navy pension. My mom had a pension from being a teacher. So like, he understood the risks he was taking on. And because he didn't take my advice of moving from stocks to bonds, he's benefited from significant growth. And his net worth is greater than what I would have expected. And this has played out a few times with other clients where they have company stock and we kind of decide how much do we sell to remove that concentration risk. And we put together a plan, and we're going to, because it's an ISO strategy, we're going to hold it this much for this long, and this is what we're going to sell and pay the large tax bill. And in part because markets that have done very well, especially over the last decade, but even since last March, the clients who have held on to the stock have really benefited. And I do think about my kind of emotions and feelings related to that, where I make sure we have enough in cash to be a good cash reserve. I make sure we talk about what some of those shorter term goals are. And if you think you might need this money within the next 10 years, we don't want to leave it all in a single company stock. But if we can address those other lifestyle goals, then sometimes it's okay to take on that risk of holding that company stock, because that's where you can get those really big returns. And it has paid off for my clients. And I guess my concern is, I know this isn't going on forever, and I'm trying to make sure that my advice or recommendations isn't kind of a recency bias thing. Like we talked about, I'm trying to make sure that I'm not too impacted by what's happened recently. And will I be able to keep providing some of those conservative recommendations and allowing is not the right word, because like you said, it's always their money, their decision, but going along with the recommendation that is the more aggressive recommendation, going along with the more aggressive strategy, and at some point it's not going to pay off. It's going to make their situation worse, that the stock is going to go down. And I would hope that because we had enough in a cash reserve, we had enough in a stock and bond portfolio to take care of those shorter term goals, that they still get to live the lifestyle they want. And they're also okay acknowledging that they understood the risk they're taking on by leaving that invested in the company stock. And I talked to other advisors about equity compensation. I'm in a few study groups. One of the advisors, she has clients in Uber. And that was kind of the perfect example of the Uber IPO did not work out for Uber employees. And they specifically were harmed by that. And so I'm kind of always cautious of that, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And it's a tough decision to be in because we live in a probabilistic world, and mm-hmm. we can give advice that we believe is sensible for 95% of the time. You know, somebody's going to be better following that advice. But at the end of the day, that 5% could very well be what ends up happening. And hopefully what we just try to move forward with is the understanding that we're not really trying to, or at least from my perspective, I just try to make it clear that I'm not trying to enforce a policy or basically come with an iron fist on how things should be done. I'm really trying to be more informative and put forward the notion that this is what I think based upon the knowledge and understanding and the research and what the markets are telling us and what history is telling us. And nothing's for certain, but given what we do know, this is what makes the most sense from my perspective. And certainly at the end of the day, a client is welcome to take that advice and go a complete 180, which is okay.
Yeah, I guess it's like I said, acknowledging your own feelings and how the behavior impact yourself, it is important to be able to make the right decision after that. I think like pretending that the feelings aren't there is probably worse.
Yeah, I agree. That makes sense to me.
Okay. Anything else that you had that you wanted to make sure we got to with behavioral finance and behavioral economics?
Well, you know, I think we covered a good amount in this episode, and hopefully we laid the groundwork or built upon our foundations from past conversations on just the notion that, yeah, we understand that the markets gravitate towards efficiency, but yes, they can also be quite inefficient for extended periods and they can employ a lot of irrationality. But given all that, it might be too hard to figure out that irrationality and try to exploit it so that one can outsmart the market. I think that's where I come out with all of this.
Yeah, I just thinking, if you go back to end of 2019, even like ignoring the pandemic stuff, which was kind of like ignore it. Everything, but just look at the stock market. It's like, oh yeah, you're gonna get a 10 to 20% rate of return. How does that feel? Like, actually, the S&P 500 says it. That's a above average year. Okay, but the way we got there does not feel like that.
Yeah, the world is way too unpredictable to try to hammer down predictions like this and make sense of them, even in a postcast perspective, as we're doing.
I remember hearing, like, sometimes I'm watching sports and like the announcers or Twitter, like the thing that actually happened, if you tried to write a story, like you're trying to write it as like a sports movie, like it would be rejected for being too unrealistic, even though it actually just happened.
Yes, I agree.
So this is good. I like this conversation today. This was a good one.
Thanks, Aaron. I enjoyed it as well. And thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're enjoying these conversations, do spread the word. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.